popularized it, deepened it. And so it's a real honor for us to have Tara here tonight. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anthony. There's some places in the front that people want. I know it's the last place you want to sit, but I won't mind if you want to leave halfway through. I honestly don't. So there are chairs here. thanks, Anthony, for the kind words. And I'm very happy that Haymarket has reprinted this collection, which, you know, as time goes on, you almost forget exists. I mean, I'd barely remembered it till Anthony dug it out from somewhere or the other. And then I was looking through it, and I was sort of, you know, it's true that Penguin Books published it. And they published it because at that time in the 80s, there was a huge debate about which way forward, a sort of decrepit capitalism or a revived living socialism. And this was a big debate. And that debate is now returning in a modest way. One shouldn't exaggerate, but people are getting interested again. So I think it's timely. And to show you how it's coming back again, I'll tell you a sort of little story. About a year ago, I was rung up by a German theater in the city of Essen, which is a big industrial town in Germany, like Manchester in England, historically a town, working class town. And the dramaturg at the Essen Theater, Kirola Neher, said, "We want you to write a play for us." And I said, "I'll, you know, be interested. What do you want me to write a play about?" And she said, "We want you to write a modern version of Don Quixote." So I said, "Yes." It's a tall order. And then the director, a French director who works with them a lot, I met him and I said, "Look, it'd be absolutely crazy to do a play which is the old characters in modern clothes. It's not going to work. So the only way to do it, I think, because I'd thought about it till then, is effectively to bring in Don Quixote and Sancho Panza out of the 17th century world into the 21st century world in their medieval clothes and let them see what's happening in this world." And I said, "So I just want to be very clear that if I write this play, it really will be a defense of radical ideas and anti-capitalism, and we will show them what is happening in this world." So he said, "Well, yes, but, you know, show them how." I said, "We will show them how bankers and politicians are in bed with each other, sometimes literally. we will show them what happens when you fight wars, killings of people who you go to kill, but your own soldiers, what happens to them." So we'll have a huge scene in a US military hospital in Germany where veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan are hanging around without legs and arms. So I said, "It's not going to be a feel-good play in that sense." And I said, "And lastly, we will tackle the thorny questions of sexuality and politics in the Middle East." So to my son, he said, "Could you just write this down in two or three?" And I did. And it's happening. And they're going to do it. And everything's been designed. And he said, I said, "Any problems?" He said, no, everyone's very keen. But do be aware that Brecht is regarded by half of Germany as a Stasi agent." I said, "Well, that's totally disgusting." He said, "It is totally disgusting, but that is the reality. So you just have to be aware of that. We're not saying." So that Brecht as a Stasi agent brings us to the topic of socialism in the 20th century and what happened to it. And basically, I'll just sort of spell out my views on it and then we can discuss and argue. I think sort of the basic thing to understand about the 20th century is that this was the first time in the history of the world that a revolution had been made in 1917 by political revolutionaries who had set out with the idea of making a socialist revolution. This wasn't accidental, like the English and French revolutions, bourgeois revolutions were. It's not that the English Puritans and the French Enlightenment revolutionaries set out with the idea we're going to make a bourgeois revolution, which will be complete the transition from feudalism to capitalism, and these are the institutions we'll set up, and we will then execute a tiny proportion of the aristocracy. No. They didn't set out like that. It happened. And it happened because there were movements, class forces, social forces from below, political struggles, social struggles in a congealed way, not like we know them now at the top. And these revolutions, including the revolution in Holland, were, if you like, uncoordinated and unthought out revolutions. The Russian Revolution was the first revolution in the history of humanity which was totally thought out. And the Lenin, not very fashionable these days, said, this is what we are going to do. We may not be able, we may not succeed, but this is the attempt to create in, on a global scale, a power structure that will benefit not just Russians, but the entire world. And you know, if you look at the impact of that revolution, it had a completely international impact. It was like lightning. It created anti-colonial movements, it encouraged liberation movements, which were not even communist in any sense of the word, but excited by this event to challenge imperialism. And you know, the Bolsheviks did think, sometimes in sort of slightly crazy ways, but for instance, when they were told at a very early period in 1919, they thought, how are we going to stop these imperial powers which are participating in our country in waging a civil war? And Trotsky says to Lenin, why don't we hit them where it'll hurt them, at the heart of their empires? So they say, yes, that's a good idea. What are we going to do? So they ask, Trotsky finds out that there are only 36,000 actual English soldiers controlling India. So he's astonished when he finds out. He says, 36,000 white soldiers, that's all? And they say, yes. So he asks his generals and marshals to prepare an emergency plan for a Red Cavalry of 25,000 people recruited largely from Central Asia, which can go through Afghanistan into India, defeat the British Imperial Army, and declare Indian independence. That's how they thought. You know, I'm glad they didn't try it, because who knows where it might have led us. But the thinking was absolutely clear. Hit the capitalist powers at their weakest points. Now, the revolution as conceived, and here we have to be very clear, what was the entire leadership of the Marxist movement in Russia. On this, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks were agreed that it was a backward country. A large bulk of the country was unorganized peasants, barely liberated from serfdom. The size of the working class was minuscule compared to the countries of Western Europe, especially Germany. So they said, what are we going to do? And for a long time they said, it's not going to be possible. What transformed it was the First World War. Because that First World War politicized the peasantry who were recruited as soldiers into the Imperial Army to go and fight. And the defeats they suffered radicalized them considerably. And it was the soldiers and workers. And for soldiers, read peasants in uniform. who effectively provided the base for the revolutionary movement that won. But despite this, the thinking of the entire Bolshevik leadership at that moment was that if the revolution doesn't take seed in Germany, we are sunk. There is no way we can build socialism in Russia. We do not have the industrial base to do it. We need German industry and the German working class to do it. And so every single thing was linked to the German Revolution. I mean, if you read the writings now, which I've been doing for other purposes, but if you read them now, it's a constant theme. If you look at the pamphlets at the time, Lenin wrote a pamphlet, so can the Bolsheviks retain state power? It wasn't a stupid question. And so they pushed and pushed and pushed. From Hungary, there's Hungary fell for a short time to a communist uprising. There was an uprising in Munich, foolish, because this is what happens when you, you know, impose a certain element of voluntarism and conditions aren't right. The big leader of the Munich uprising, a communist, said to the leaders in Moscow, "I don't think the timing is right." Was told, "Go for it. The timing is never right," which is also not untrue. He went for it, and it failed. And he made one of the most moving speeches in communist history, in his trial, said, "Yeah, we lost. But you have to understand," he said to the court, "we communists are dead people on leave. Our lives don't matter. We will carry on trying. You can execute me." And they executed him the following day. And then they tried it in Berlin, where Rosa Luxemburg was completely opposed to it, because she said, "It is not right. We do not have a majority of workers with us. Many of them are still loyal to the German Social Democratic Party. It's an adventure." But the decision had been taken by the Spartacus Bund. And they went for it. And they lost, and in this process, we lost in Germany the most capable, intelligent, gifted leaders of the German working class. And you know, it's not totally inapposite to refer that this is what happens when you have revolutions, full stop, that the successful revolutionary country wants to push and push because they know they can't survive on their own. The French did it. They did it in a deformed way via Napoleon, but Napoleon said, "Unless we get Europe, they will surround and destroy the gains of the French Revolution." He was right on that, actually, completely right. And had he succeeded in destroying Tsarism, which he didn't, for reasons, you know, too long to discuss now, when he invaded Russia, the plan was to destroy Tsarism, initial plan, completely give rights to the peasants, give them the code Napoleon, and distribute the land. Had they done that, it might have been a different story. They didn't do that. He fought the war in a conventional way. But the aim was that. And then the aim was also to set up republics. So when you don't set up republics but create little monarchies, it doesn't help either. But that was the plan. But forget the French Revolution. You come just in the modern world to the Cuban Revolution. I'm just saying that this is a weakness of successful revolutionary. The Cubans win in Cuba through a combination of circumstances. One is that the Americans were totally unprepared for this event on their doorstep, completely unprepared for it, and the revolution succeeds, and they chuck out all the American companies, etc., etc. Then they realize, we're a tiny island, and we need other Latin American countries with us. And so what worked in Cuba, and even in Cuba it worked, by the way, worked in the sense of being successful and keeping the United States at bay. It worked because it was not simply the armed struggle groups, which were very important. There was a mass movement, the July the 26th movement, in the cities. They had urban organization. And so to use the Foucault theory, that a small group of armed revolutionaries can trigger off a revolution anywhere. We did it in Cuba, and we can do... It's, you know, when you think back on it now, it's completely schematic. And they try it in Argentina, where you have a huge workers' movement totally under the hegemony of Peronism, which is a mixed blessing, but it is a blessing because it actually gave the workers a lot of rights in Argentina. And to think you can climb, jump over the Argentinian workers' movement with the crazy idea of a FOCO in a very obscure part of the country on the Bolivian border, it was a disaster. And then, okay, so it's a disaster, you learn from it. And then you repeat that disaster a year later in Bolivia. And you know, I try and understand these things. It's not that these are very intelligent people. All over the Bolsheviks, of course, were the most gifted political leaders that Europe has produced. But the Cuban leadership wasn't stupid either, nor were the French before them. What it's the arrogance in a way of success creates, partially, that you think you can do it. Because we've done it, and God, we didn't think we'd be able to do it. And if we've done it, you can do it. And the analysis of conditions, social conditions, relationship of social forces is never worked out. And the groups in these countries are so much in awe of the people who've succeeded that they go against their own better judgments and carry out the orders. Always a mistake to blindly carry out the orders of some parent group in some other country without thinking about the concrete conditions in your own country. Always a mistake. If the conditions are right, fine, great. But if they're not, and you know, the result is in South America, again, we lost in every single South American country incredibly gifted, courageous people. The same in Germany. And the people who killed Luxembourg and Liebknecht were the people then who brought the fascists to power. One shouldn't isolate these two processes. Very closely linked. But for me, the question, therefore, is, okay, the revolution has been defeated. It has not taken off in Europe, so the Russian Revolution is totally isolated. What do you do? That was the big debate which gripped Russia in the 1920s. And that is a debate which is still of importance to us today, not just as history, but to learn the lessons from that debate. That in these conditions, the one thing you never do is disenfranchise the people who make the revolution. And say, we know better. They are demoralized, it's true. They've had enough. They've suffered the First World War, in which millions died. They've suffered their own civil war, in which 22 foreign armies intervened on the side of the whites against them. The masses get exhausted, naturally. Look at Afghanistan today. They've been fighting now, the peasants in Afghanistan, since the Russians went in. And they haven't stopped fighting. I mean, it is amazing they still do it. But I know from talking to people that they just are now reaching their limits, saying after the Americans, we kick them out, we hope no one else intervenes because we don't think we'd be able to handle it. I was told this by an Afghan in Pakistan 6 months ago. So, when the masses are exhausted, you have to understand that it's a hiatus. The decision the Bolsheviks made, largely, I think, because the revolutions failed in Germany, was to completely become a sort of Iron Curtain. I hate that phrase, but a fortress state. And then you do the logic of what you have done before: emergency, civil war, all other political formations banned. And once you ban all other political formations, it's one thing to say all the political formations who are helping the whites, like conservatives and the cadets, they can't be allowed legality because they've taken up arms against us. That's acceptable. But to ban all left organizations because they're not in your own party, it's a huge error. Huge error. And this error became institutionalized after the death of Lenin. He, to his credit, actually, I would advise those who haven't read it to read Lenin's Last Will and Testament. It's a very moving document, just on a human level. Here is a leader paralyzed by a stroke in 1922, about to die, who looks at what has been created and is partially horrified. And in his letter, he actually apologizes to the Russian working class. He says that, I apologize, I'm sorry that I allowed this to happen, accepts responsibility. But that also indicates that had he been in full health, together with others, they might have been able to stem the rot. Because the rot that then takes place, once you ban all other parties, you then ban dissent in your own organizations. It's logical. So anyone who's trying to argue against the leadership is regarded as an enemy and driven out or killed in the case of the Stalinist takeover within that party, and then follow the purges and the trials. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that Stalin killed more Bolsheviks and revolutionaries than the Tsar did. That's just a fact of history. That then creates further demoralization, and a dictatorship sets in, which is monstrous. And this dictatorship is then presented to the world as socialism. And many people look, millions and millions accept it. Small minorities don't, but they are small, tiny. But by and large, the world accepts it, and the world thinks this is the way things have to be if we're going to get socialism. And that was not the case. And this wretched institutional structure created by Stalinism then becomes the norm and the model for many liberation movements who are fighting against imperialism, because imperialism is the enemy, and they link any form of democracy with imperialism, saying, well, we were screwed up by democracies. Britain, France, the Germans, the Dutch, creating these huge empires were democracies. Why should we mimic that? So they completely equate democracy and imperialism. And therefore they go for the structure which also helps the local bourgeois elites, or the, you know, fighting for independence, but very much within a bourgeois nationalist framework, that, okay, this is the method we're going to do. So throughout Africa, one party, one state, one leader. The Cubans accept that model. I mean, admittedly under pressures, because they had no options left once there was no development in the rest of South America, but still a huge mistake in my opinion. And with that goes a monopoly of politics and a monopoly of information. And why that monopoly of politics and information is wrong is not for moral reasons, but for very practical reasons. That if you completely close down all debate and discussion in the country, then who the hell is going to tell you that you're wrong? Neither in Russia nor in Mao's China were they prepared to listen to people who said you're going wrong, because there was no institutional structure in which workers or peasants or intellectuals could express it. I'm not even now talking about alternative parties, though I'm in favor of them. I'm saying Soviet-style structures, workers' councils, peasants' councils, in which you have regular meetings attended by representatives from workers and peasants who say, hey guys, this idea of transforming everything into people's communes isn't working. We can't build a furnace in every backyard. Saying to Stalin, the industrialization process and the way you've pushed it through is not working. The result is mass famines and millions are dying. And if the revolution is going to produce effectively cannibalism in the Ukraine, well, we're not going along with it. I mean, no structures exist for that. And so, and then the term is invented, enemies of the people. But these are the people who are effectively wanting these changes. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, subjective and objective, that is what we were landed with. And as long as you had a strong workers' movement in Western Europe, these things could be argued still. But with the weaknesses of the workers' movement and sort of total bourgeois domination, actually, and I'm not exaggerating, I mean, living in Britain today is really depressing. I know it's not great here either, but... but, you know, in Britain, it's a sort of tiny country now, effectively a vassal state of the United States. Its culture wrecked. Its political parties in general agreement with each other. So the hegemony of the United States globally, I mean, economically, the States is sort of suffering and it's weakened by rivalries. But politically, militarily, it remains very strong. So you have a Europe which has effectively been Americanized, not to put too fine a point on it. You know, Labour and Conservatives are very similar to Republican and Democrat parties. One has a few, you know, one has a layer of people who are people we could run into and have a drink with. Not go beyond that, but certainly we could do that. Germany is virtually the same. Look at Italy today. It's a complete mess. This is a country which produced the finest Marxist intellectuals in Western Europe. Gone, dead. The Communist Party self-destructed. They had no option. They moved to the right. The trade unions weak, politically and organizationally. And of course, the basis on which this happened is neoliberalism, which, you know, is deindustrialization, which is we don't want a working class, strong working class. The destruction of the mining communities was not because they were convinced that this was at an end and we were going to have nuclear power or gas. It was not. It was to destroy the absolute foundations of the English labor movement. And they are very open about it. Seamus Milne has written a very good book, The Enemy Within, which maps out how Thatcher actually destroyed the miners' communities, which is why many miners' community were actually celebrating when she died. I mean, you know, I'm not, it was a sort of, the only victory they had was her death. And in this situation, we have, as a result of all this, and by the way, the debates in this book, The Stalinist Legacy, are all about what I've been talking about. You know, with debates which erupted after the Stalinization of the Soviet Union in one form or another. Not popular debates, but debates between intellectuals, people trying to analyze it, people who refuse to go to the right. One thing that unifies all the contributors to this collection are none of them moved towards the right. They said, yeah, okay, it's a screw up, but there's a lot to fight for. And I think that is still the case, however bad times are, that one doesn't give up, because what do you give up for? For a better world? No. And this also, I think, explains the hatred with which the media still treats anything mildly radical. It's much worse. The time when the Western media was actually more diverse and allowed more space to dissenting voices, and why books like this were published by mainstream houses, one reason for it was that they wanted to show the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europeans, look, this is what democracy means. Now they don't need to show anyone. Well, why should they bother allowing divergent dissenting voices? So you have, I don't know whether some of you, I mean, The Economist, of course, symbolizes this. And you have these two economists, one in praise of Margaret Thatcher, and one cover with Hugo Chavez, his picture on the cover saying Chavez's rotten legacy. And the rotten legacy is what? That he was using state money to push through a sort of radical social democratic program. Even that is now unacceptable. And that is what the culture tells us day in and day out. It is not possible. And you see the effect of this in what is going on in the mainstream capitalist world. You have the Wall Street crash in 2008, bankruptcy of financialization, neoliberal ideas, neoliberal politics. People blame the banks, concentrating fire on the banks, which is, of course, totally correct, but miss out the fact that the people who gave the bankers these powers was the politicians. That it was a combined ruling class. It wasn't just a few bankers going crazy and saying, hey, should we do this as well? Should we, you know, do futures or just do retail banking? It wasn't that. It was, this is the way that capitalism is going to go. And they decided effectively to destroy the workers' movement, you know, not openly, not through brutalities, but defeating strikes and moving. Someone once asked me, I can't remember, it's either in somewhere in Illinois on the West Coast, what do you think about the American working class now? And I said, the bulk of it is working in China. That is what is happening. And that is what has happened. It wasn't at all necessary, but it was happened to maintain and preserve capitalist profits in the countries, a combination of financialization and using reserve armies of labor in huge third world countries. And that, of course, has not played out as yet, by the way, neither China nor India. There, the game is not over. It's barely starting. Because you now have the largest proletariat in the world in China. You have large numbers of Western countries, if not the bulk of the continents, dependent on cheap commodities from China. And if that blows, which it could well in the next 10 years in some shape or form, or say, to be more pessimistic, 20 years, the effect of that is going to be global. The effect of that is going to be global. Have no doubt about it. Likewise in India. It's not a settled, stable state. And what you're not having in China and India are what they were all said, you know, it was going to happen. That, of course, we will have the European development replicated in China and India, peasants coming into the towns, the creation of a new, wonderful urban civilization based on democracy, this, that, and the other, like hell it is. In fact, the Chinese have demonstrated very concretely that there's no link between democracy and capitalism, that you can run an extremely dynamic capitalist state without giving an inch of democracy or democratic rights to anyone. So this one central theme of bourgeois ideology throughout the 20th century, democracy and capitalism go together, dictatorship and communism or socialism go together, is absolute rubbish. But it's rubbish based on historical facts, of course, for which we're still paying the price. And the way they won these countries back to capital and Western investments was essentially through maneuvers and negotiations. I mean, the Chinese did their own business by saying, you know, we are going to introduce capitalism under our own control. Whether you like them or not, that is what they are doing. And they claim this, they can change, and it's true, the state has much more control over what is happening in China. In Russia, the party and bureaucracy, totally bankrupted, had no way looking forward to the future, just caved in. They didn't even ask anything in return, not even the disbandment of NATO, which they could have demanded. Saying, we're going to disband the Warsaw Pact, let's do this for starters, to show your goodwill. We're going to disband the Warsaw Pact, you disband NATO. Then we'll talk about what will happen in East Germany. No, it was not that. It was on their knees before the West, saying, we love you, we really want to be like you, help us. And this happened virtually all over Eastern Europe. And there's a very interesting passage in Trotsky's book, which was published here as The Revolution Betrayed, but its actual title is Where is Russia Going? In which he said that the two choices facing Russia in the foreseeable future are either it moves towards socialism and democracy, socialist democracy, or, he said, sections of the bureaucracy will basically sell out and become capitalists, private capitalists as we know them. This was written in the early 30s. Pretty much vindicated. Because a lot of these joker mafia millionaires you see creating mayhem on the streets of New York and London, or their agents, most of them were members of, in the case of the Russian billionaires in London who owned football clubs and newspapers and stuff, they were quite a lot of them were activists in the Young Communist League in Russia. That's their background. And they talk about it. They say, yeah, well, we did learn how to run organizations. So to conclude, is despite the 2008 crisis, nowhere in Europe or North America has there been any attempt by any mainstream party, center left, center right, to say enough is enough. This can't go on because our people are suffering. And we are not, just a simple thing. We are not going to allow the rich to benefit permanently, not to pay taxes, to have their special bank accounts in safe havens, to rob, to steal, to pay themselves huge bonuses. We're not going to allow this. This, quite honestly, what I'm saying is not even that radical. It is capitalist legality. But they won't even legalize their own system properly because they are fearful that if the state begins to intervene again and save some parts of the structures which should carry on existing, this applies more to Europe than the United States, but even here, who knows what could happen? People might get encouraged to demand more. It could change the political situation. It could lead to a change in consciousness. Better not to go in that direction. So the direction they're going in is more of the same. Just carry on doing what we were doing. And this is creating mayhem. One of the theorists of this mayhem, who I ran into New York yesterday, Michael Hart, said to me, I said, Europe is in a really bad state. And he said, but why is being ungovernable bad? And I said, being ungovernable is bad because if there is no left or progressive organization, the people who benefit from this ungovernability are by and large the right. And I took him through what's happening in Europe. I said, that's what happens. You think a bunch of clowns have won in Italy. Well, the guy is a clown, but he's a sinister clown. Yeah. It's not an innocent thing. The ideology behind all this is elitist and quite right wing. Just like the Pirates Party in Germany and in Sweden. It's not innocence. And quite a lot of them are already being infiltrated by people. And in Greece, the Golden Dawn is a self-avowed Nazi organization. There's no two ways about it. And in France, you have a huge social and political crisis at the moment. And the large manifestations which take place, organized by the right and the Catholic Church, are against gay marriages. 1 million people marched in Paris against gay weddings, which have been legalized. And this is a country which is supposed to be secular. This is a country which bans Muslim women from wearing the hijab if they want to. and they're showing their secularity and their republicanness by marching a million people out on the streets, a million, against gays. And no march, no demonstration against the huge unemployment figures, against the total failure of the Socialist Party. It's true, I think they're going to organize, there should be this week a big demonstration for a new republic, the Sixth Republic. We'll see how many people that gets. I don't think there's going to be a million coming out for that, saying, get rid of this entire corrupt structure. Let's have a new constituent assembly to prepare a new constitution which takes the presidential powers away, gives powers back to parliament, not one semi-monarchical president. It's a popular, you know, it's a good thing the left is doing. And we'll see what happens. It's not the center-left, it's the far-left and its allies who are doing this, but good. It's at least doing something. But within mainstream politics, there is no movement at all. And this, I think, is going to lead to much more unpleasantness that we've seen. And so, you know, when I'm asked to speak all over Europe, which I am often, I say, you know, I have to say this to you, that the solution is socialism. And I don't mean it in a sort of abstract way, a utopian socialism, no. I mean the state and working class people and public sector workers have to do something to safeguard their interests, the interests of the poor, the interests of the unemployed, the interests of kids who can't afford to pay for their education. The number of working class kids going into universities all over Europe has come right down. Who is going to defend them? So that is the level of the debate. And that is why there's so much hatred and anger and fear of Chavez, actually. Because, you know, I've written about him at length, I knew him very well, and he was very clear in what he was doing. It was essentially a left social democratic program. I mean, they use rhetoric, this is the revolution, fine, good. But effectively, that's what it was. And that is the example they really wanted to wipe out. Not permitted, verboten. So you saw, I mean, it's astonishing the uniformity of views and opinions about Chavez in the American and European media. Virtually the same. You know, in Britain it's slightly different, we still have The Guardian. But in France, all the papers, Le Monde devoted 3 pages of pure poison. El País the same. Germans marginally more nuanced. But that, and the American press is beyond belief, but then we know that. And the American television networks likewise. But this is why no alternative is permitted. And this is why we have to struggle in small and big ways for that alternative. Because quite honestly, if we don't, the people who are organizing all over the place in different ways, whether it's through the church and religion, or openly is semi-fascist, or is right-wing populist, is the right. They are on the march, and the left is extremely weak. And one reason the left is weak is because many of them hang on to the coattails of the center-left, in my opinion. You look at this country. You know, 90% of the things Obama is doing, had they been done by Bush, there would have been uproar. Absolute uproar if Bush had arrogated powers to kill any American citizen at will. Effectively removed civil liberties from the agenda of American politics. There would have been uproar if there had been a hunger strike of Guantanamo prisoners under Bush. In fact, Bush released more Guantanamo prisoners than Obama has done. Just a fact, by the way. More drone attacks on Pakistan under the Obama in the first 2 years, then throughout the Bush term. And yet American liberalism is just sort of dying on its feet. They can't see this happening. And what this creates is effectively a precedent. The next time a Republican gets elected and does this, you won't have a leg to stand on, not you people here, but I mean those who have just decided to back Obama. You know, for whatever reason, he's a Democrat, I guess, and he's mixed race, and he looks good. But, I mean, not a sufficient reason. And politics has gone out of the window. And that is in a different way. These politics are being refracted in Europe. I mean, I do not exaggerate. You know this vacuous slogan by Obama, "Yes, we can," which even he in private admits is vacuous. It was used by an Italian leader of the left party during the last campaign, Veltroni, in English to Italian. "Yes, we can." Looking at it, you say, what the hell is going on? I mean, you know, have you got nothing else to say? And the answer is, no, they haven't. They haven't. All they want to do is run the system, make money. And so it's, yes, we can. We can make more money if we're in power. We are, the people backing us will benefit. Berlusconi's benefited for a long time. Exactly the same thing happening in Britain. Blair's turned out to be one of the more corrupt politicians we've seen, currently on the payroll of the Kazakhstan government. And here let me tell you an interesting story. The Kazakhstan PR people who run that country's public relations rang up Clinton, who's also on their payroll. And they said, you know, we need some Europeans. And Clinton said, why don't you try my friend Blair? They said, fine, great. So they rang up Blair. And Blair's office spoke to them. And they said, we'd like Tony Blair to come and meet our president and, you know, be seen with him and give him advice. And the Blair's agent said, how much? And they said, well, $1 million. And he said, we'll give you a reply. And they said, no. So they rang up, this is all public, by the way. So they rang up Clinton and said, you told us Tony Blair was willing to come on, and you know, he's fucking saying no. And Clinton said, how much did you offer him? They said, $1 million. He said, oh, come on, put it up.
This is the best part.
Put it up a bit. So they said, well, how much should we offer him? He said, you know, I'm not saying you should give him what you gave me, but at least offer him $5 million. So they offered him $5 million, deal done. Blair flies off to Kazakhstan with his old advisors from New Labour in tow. They gave me advice, they'll give you advice, and this is all going on. And meanwhile, they all unite again to commemorate and mark Thatcher's legacy. Just one word on Thatcher's legacy. This legacy could have been destroyed. It was never popular, by the way. If you look at the votes with which she was elected, always a minority vote, never a majority vote in the country. So the legacy was up for being destroyed. New Labour effectively built on that legacy and created the structure which is now a Britain. It was Labour who did that. Till this day, whenever the Tories are going to privatise something, introduce more neoliberal measures, Labour can't speak. When they get up, the Tories say, but hang on, these papers we've got from the civil servants, you wrote them, you guys, you approved them, and now you've got the nerve to attack us. And when the Tory, and interestingly, you know, there's a huge anger in Britain that she was being given a public funeral at public expense as if she was sort of some great entity. Huge anger. And some Conservatives MPs privately told the media, without being named, they said, well, look, we didn't want to do this. But the entire plan for the funeral was set up under Gordon Brown's government. We're just implementing it, and this was absolutely true. So Labour even wanted to send her off like this. So the lesson from all this is bad things are happening, and have happened, and will carry on happening, and we're living in bad times to a certain extent, but we must never give up, because, you know, to give up, to despair, what's the point of doing that? I mean, despair is a very passive emotion, actually. It creates passivity. Whereas hope, even in bad times, is important to keep your minds active. Very important. And you know, you think about the midpoints of the 20th century. Were they worse than now? Yes, they bloody well were. when you had most of Europe under the Nazis, Russia under hard Stalinism, the reforms came after 56. But that's what you had. The midnight of our century, as Victor Serge called it. It's not as bad as that now. So one has to have a sense of perspective. But it means that, you know, the need to exploit, to use every space, to take the struggle forward, some advantages we have, which we didn't have in those periods. And politics becomes extremely important. The Middle East explosions teach us that. If you think that just having uprisings on its own is enough, it isn't. Because ultimately, people have to choose what's on offer. And so they choose these Islamist parties, socially, politically, economically conservative Islamist parties, partially because they were repressed by the dictatorships, but partially because there's nothing else on offer. And so both in Tunisia and Egypt, it's a mess. And the lesson of this mess is not to say, oh, the uprisings are wrong, far from it. It's to say politics remains extremely important. And without politics remaining in command, or by hiding one's politics, you can't move forward. And others take over. And so this sort of, you know, quite popular theme, it's a sort of semi-anarchist theme, though that was not the problem in Egypt, by the way. But in the Occupy movements, it's a similar thing, no demands. But, you know, if you don't make any demands, however modest, you can't move forward, you can't win over other people. You have to have at least a minimum charter of 10 demands. This is what we need today, the country needs today, we're prepared to fight for it. To pose no demands at all is to give up. And so then you're forced to do is effectively become, celebrate on the web or on paper, your successes. And the successes were that you actually occupied a space, which was great and we all supported it. But on its own, it's not enough. And observing anniversaries of it every year doesn't help either. Because it actually shows up what our weaknesses are. I'll stop there. You're getting nervous.
No, I definitely wasn't nervous. Thank you so much. So we'll have a little bit of time for questions. Unfortunately, I already anticipate we're not going to have time to flesh out all the questions in the room, but I'm thinking maybe after this we can, you know, have some more informal discussion. Tariq Ali is available to sign books, and people should check out the Haymarket books table in the back. So if you and don't forget the wine and
the bottles are open, so
so we have to finish them. It's necessary. Okay, so if you do have a question, you know, we're
anybody
just
worried
Q&A.
About being on video?
You know, I apologize in advance if we can't get to everyone. You can go ahead.
Oh, this is a first of all, thank you so much for a wonderful, enlightening historical overview of the damage that Stalinism has done to the international movement for socialism. I am very glad that you mentioned the complexity of dealing with sexual politics in the Middle Eastern context, and I'm wondering if you would say something about that in the Indian context at all, because I've been following Vandana Shiva, who's been talking about how capitalist patriarchy, specifically in the wake of some horrible incidents of rape in India, has been exacerbating violence against women. And I'm also very going to quickly say that as a Jewish feminist and democratic socialist, there's a word that I have to add to this room when we talk about Stalinism, and that word is explicitly anti-Semitism. It's a legacy of anti-Semitism.
Okay. Just very briefly on both those questions. India is in social economic terms, the general image you get of India, you know, which they tried to promote for a long time, was shining India. Capitalism is flourishing, all is well, money is trickling down. And the poor are not so poor. Well, if you actually look at the statistics, what you see is that there's no doubt there has been a rise in the numbers of the middle classes who have more money. But for the bulk of the Indian population, this is not the case. What is the case is there's a lot more informal labor, very precarious, very fragile, completely unorganized, which in order to get work when it can't live in one place. It has to move from city to city to city. So in both China and India, there is huge internal migrations, but on a vast scale. And the wages they get are pretty appalling. There's a very, I mean, if you want to read more in it, I would recommend the work of a Dutch scholar, Jan Jan J-A-N Breman, B-R-E-M-A-N, who's written a whole study on poverty in India, and whose essays are, two of his essays we published in the New Left Review, which you can get on the website. As for rape and patriarchy, yeah, this is true, unfortunately, not only in India, but in large parts of the world, and sometimes in places where one hoped not to find it. But it certainly is the case. In India, at least you had a huge mobilization. But you know, one problem in India is that they still will not make rape a crime for soldiers. And some of the largest episodes of rape that take place in India are in the northeast, in Manipur, occupied by the Indian Army, and in Kashmir, occupied by the Indian Army, where the Indian military high command has fought tooth and nail to prevent laws against rape from applying to the army, because they say we are operating in situations, there are enemies, but you know, do you rape your enemies? I mean, and the Indian government has caved in. So this is a patriarchy very much instituted from the top. Stalinism and anti-Semitism. It is not the case that anti-Semitism existed in Russia on the left till later on, and then it was used effectively. And you know, if you talk to scholars, Russian scholars, scholars on Russia, they will tell you that the big change which happened, which made them very nervous, wrongly, but they did, having backed Israel and the formation of Israel, which Stalin did, they forgot the impact of this within Russia. And the first state visit by Golda Meir to Moscow saw a spontaneous demonstration, largely Jewish, welcoming her. And after that, the regime turned and went crazy. You know, the Jewish doctors plot and this plot. But prior to that, it was limited. It never disappeared, but it was limited. But in terms of anti-Semitism that existed in Russia as a whole, historically, of course, it's on gigantic proportions. And people who say that it's a pity the revolution happened, some well-meaning people, and the implication is that if it hadn't been these horrible Leninists and Bolsheviks, we'd have had some nice, kind, social, Scandinavian-style social democracy. Well, no. What you would have had would have been a military dictatorship backed by the Black Hundreds and based on essentially exterminism towards the Russian Jews. That's what you would have had. They would have given preceded the Third Reich in doing this. So anti-Semitism, if you read Isaac Babel's short stories, by the way, during the Civil War, you get a fairly good idea of how it was. But there's a very interesting book now out called The Jewish Century by a Russian Jewish scholar, I've forgotten his name, who teaches on the West Coast. And it's a very well-researched history. And in it, he says that the 20th century, there were two heavens for the Jews and there was one hell. And the heavens were the United States, because they could come here and make money and prosper. And the other heaven was the Soviet Union, where the revolution liberated them. In fact, the anti-Semites in Russia, I mean, the common chant was, the Jews have taken over our country. That was the anti-Semitic Black Hundreds chant. We are against the revolution because the Jews have taken the country. And they used to say, look at the composition of the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party, or the Politburo, 80% Jewish intellectuals or workers. So this was used against the Russians, but I think his name is Levine. I'm sorry, I've forgotten it. And he says that the rise of the Jews from the Pales, from the ghettos, to not just the upper reaches of Soviet society, but on every level of it, was unprecedented and very liberating. And then he says bureaucrats, Stalin, of course, in a crazy way, and Brezhnev later made anti-Semitic measures. But the arguments Brezhnev used to use is that if we have no restrictions, then they'll take everything over because they're the most intelligent people in the country. A sort of backhanded compliment, if you like. But saying so that we have to restrict, that we have to have a Jewish quota, which, by the way, existed in Britain right till the 60s. A whole number of schools, private schools, not state schools, used to have a Jewish quota using very Brezhnevite arguments, saying, well, you know, if there's no control, the whole school would be Jewish. And you say, well, so what? But so it's a complicated.
Thank you. I had a question. You brought up a really good point that's totally underreported about in the United States and Europe, the increasing amount of unemployment, underemployment, and increasing uneducation now at this point. Historically, in your own judgment and expertise, do you know any historical cases of that work happening in the working class, of unemployment, mass unemployment in the same sort of place of today, and where that leads to?
Well, of course, we had it during the Great Depression in the United States and elsewhere. The 20s and 30s were periods of huge unemployment and a breakdown of the social order. This breakdown of the social order in parts of Europe created a big struggle between the left and the right, which the right won in Germany. That's what the struggle was about, a different dispensation. And it's a long story about the victory of fascism in Germany, which was a huge disaster for the entire European working class, but that grew out of two things. One, the Depression, and prior to that, the way in which the Germans were treated after the First World War. Punished. Not allowed their own sovereignty. Completely sort of kept under the control. And that created a national German nationalism. And then came the Depression, and you know, you had large amounts of sort of people walking on the streets unemployed, inflation rose to amazing heights, and the result was a confrontation in which the German capitalist class backed the fascists because they said a Bolshevik victory in Germany would finish us all. So we have had this experience before, and in the United States, of course, you had the following development. You had an aggressive rise of the labor movement in this country, in the fight for trade unionizing themselves, against the post-depression measures that were being taken. Factories were occupied. The working class in the United States, in my opinion, was, not all of them, but their most advanced elements were politicized in the 30s like at no other time. And the New Deal was a response to that pressure from below. It was a response to the existence of the Soviet Union too, which on paper had no unemployment. And people saw it as a model, you know, whether we like it or not. It was seen as that, and the bourgeoisie saw it as a model. And then movements from below that created the conjuncture. But even the New Deal measures were not on their own enough to stave off the Depression. This is not often discussed. What finally helped American capitalism to recover was the war. the Second World War actually revived the American economy much more than the measures that were taken during the Depression, which is a horrific thought. But it's something we now know, that the military-industrial links still, to this day, keep a lot of American industry going.
I have in the back, and keep your hands up just until I acknowledge you.
Tariq, I want to ask you a question about your book. And first, I do want to thank you, because I think we're going to have hope. It should be based on something. We're not religious here. I mean, some people may be, but we're a second movement left, and I think it has to be based on knowing how the whole got into such a fucking mess. So thank you. And I guess I want to ask you, you started off the whole talk tonight talking about how the Russian Revolution was the first and only revolution at that time that went into revolution with a plan,
yeah,
organization, and a thought about how to transform themselves, but also the entire world in doing it, and then went on to talk about the very brilliant people went on to lead various communist parties around the world,
yeah,
to disaster, to Stalinist disaster in Egypt. What is, from your, because I see the chapter, I'm very excited about reading this, it's sort of a sort of tour through the wreckage of Stalinism from Hungary and China and on. What is the central feature that you see as running through this wreckage of these parties? Is it primarily the deracination from class struggle? Is it that in combination with so many other factors that there is no one? What is it that you conclude as being, if it's possible, if that's too simplistic a way to,
yeah,
find that?
Well, you know, in my opinion, and of course there's a huge debate around it, it was a combination of two things. One, of course, that the revolution was isolated. Second, that the working class and the forces that had made the revolution were either exhausted or dead, killed during the Civil War. What's often not known, but some scholars have now told us and found the evidence, is that a lot of the most active Russian workers, the most politically advanced, went into the Red Army to fight off the whites. They needed these elements to politicize. Lots of them were killed. The combination of that created a mood in which people were ready almost to accept anything for a quiet life, politically. And for me, the central problem with the revolution was that it failed to institutionalize Soviets and the instruments of workers' democracy, which did exist. This was the most original thing, if you like, within the political structures that were thrown up, because Tsarism was an absolutist dictatorship. The Soviets were a response by workers and other sections of the community to create a popular sovereignty. And the revolution wasn't, even Lenin understood that very well. It was only when the Bolsheviks won a majority in the Petrograd and Moscow Soviets that they went for power. They said, now we have a majority. So they understood the need for this. This was, you know, for reasons which outlined, disappeared. So I think political democracy is absolutely key for the success of socialism and socialist upheavals and revolutions. That's the key lesson that has to be learned. Economically, we'll have problems, you know, who won't? But as long as you have political democracy, which is more meaningful now than capitalist democracy, which we see what it's producing, I think we're lost. So I think that it is on the level of political structure that socialism has to be taken forward. And, you know, admit it. I mean, I always say, you know, not demagogically really, but because I mean it, the number of times capitalism has failed. Yeah. Dozens. Socialism has failed once, and we're told we can never have it again. Well, you know, we will have it again, for God's sake, somewhere or the other.
Yeah, thanks. Tariq, you made the connection between the loss of the work class losing power in the Soviet Union, basically, to the party, basically, because they were not able to object, they were not able to express if they were in the wrong direction. So, and the right worldwide, the bourgeoisie, has made that linkage now, dictatorship and socialism. When you say socialism or communism, you know, they're linked to this lack of democracy. How can we decouple that going down the road? How can we liberate socialism from this stigma of really?
Well, you know, it is difficult to uncouple it in the abstract. We will need an example, which is why I've argued, you know, forcefully over the years, that whatever the limitations of the process in Venezuela, it was very democratic. And this is the one area in which we've actually struck at the right, the center-right and the center-left, by showing them concretely that the Venezuelans put into practice the most democratic constitution in the world, saying if you collect so many signatures, you have the right to recall a president. This is straight out of the Paris Commune, and I know that that was where the ideas went from.
Right.
So from our point of view, that has been very good, because even the people who hate the Venezuelan leadership know that that's true. So you had 99 or 95% of the private media, which is watched by a majority of the population, allowed to function. Even after they prepared to organize a coup d'etat, many told Chavez, for God's sake, can you imagine what would have happened in any Western country had a television network organized? He said, we don't care about that. You know, I mean, obviously we're not like that. So they didn't even ban that television and arrest it, who were organizing an armed insurrection against an elected government. Were allowed to carry on. Many people privately said, you know, at least some examples should have been made. A few generals involved in the coup should be executed. He said, no, let them leave the country. Let them go to Miami. Much better that way. So these for South America were very important examples. And in fact, you know, I even said at a public lecture in Havana, I said, you have strengths and the Venezuelans have strengths, and you should learn from each other's strengths, not weaknesses. And I said, the strength of the Venezuelans is that they've shown it is possible on the basis of mass mobilizations, which were very important, to create a social democracy within capitalism. I said, it's not going far enough. It's not like you, who've totally rubbed out capitalism, but at a cost too. It's not going like that, but you have a lot to learn. And this debate now does take place in South America. And a lot of South Americans say we didn't win through the armed struggle, which would have been nicer, but we are beginning to win some things back. But elsewhere in the world, there's very little like that. So that's how the decoupling. It's the only way I can see the decoupling taking place. I mean, the one European country, I don't want to exaggerate this, but where it could have happened and it might still happen is Greece, where you had the sudden rise of a left-wing socialist alliance of groups and parties, which jumped from a piddling percentage coming very close to taking power. And the European bourgeoisie panicked. Every single leader went to Greece to frighten the Greek people. If you vote for Syriza, you're finished, you'll starve, there won't be any more medicines left for you. And still they came within a whisker of winning. Now, the question is, what would they have done had they won? And this is the big debate which carries on. Many of us said in Greece, that key, you know, important measures have to be taken. You quit the euro yourselves, re-establish the drachma, institute immediately a form of, let's call it, social planning to make sure that no Greek starves, etc., etc. And, you know, better economists than me had drafted out whole programs which are still being discussed. And it's partially as a response to this that you had the state, elements within the state security backing the fascists. Because the Greek fascists, as they are and should be called, have strong support inside the paratroopers and inside the special police within Athens, which go back a long way, actually. They have a history. So it's the one country where there is a critical situation still, and we shouldn't give up on that.
When Cyprus was speaking...
Sorry, we have such limited time. We want to hear from as many people as possible questions. So I have, unfortunately, I only have time for about two more questions, but like I said, this can be the beginning, not the end of the discussion. So in the back in blue, followed by the man in red.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great. A couple related, or a comment related to a question. I really appreciated what you said about Lenin's last will and testament. I'm currently reading, actually, the Fourth Congress of the Comintern Proceedings, and Lenin gives one of his last speeches, and one of the things he says over and over again is, we have done foolish things. No doubt we have done foolish things. We have made mistakes. And then he says, but we've done foolish things for this reason, because you guys have encircled us,
because we've
gotten no support, et cetera. What you guys do is for all the wrong reasons. And one of the things that comes across over and over again is this sense of like narrowing time and narrowing constraints and being able to figure it out, but also that things were still open and things could have gone a different direction. And I was struck what you said at the end, and I really agree about like Egypt and Occupy and that sentiment that like organization in itself, politics in itself, debate in itself somehow leads to dictatorship. That we'll have a pure, spontaneous revolution this time, a flowering. And I'm wondering if like the talk you gave in this process of uncovering how did Stalinism come to be, what is that legacy, what are those, you know, what was the reality in a more dynamic, complex understanding what took place, is that also part of contributing to a political project of rebuilding that kind of left that's not tied to the center left that we see today? Because I do think there's a radical left emerging, but it feels so politically tied down, underconfident, unopen, that could put socialism back on the agenda and, you know, restore a democratic reputation of socialism, but is afraid to do so. So I guess I wonder what you see about the prospects for that and the role of books like this and talks like this, etc.
Well, look, I mean, I've been talking about that. I'm not going to repeat myself, but I think these, you know, the fact that socialism is being debated again and alternatives are being discussed today, not just by us or small groups of people, but by huge mass movements in parts of Europe, especially Greece, I have to stress that, not so much in Italy or Spain or Portugal. It's regrettable, but the reason they aren't is, and here too, you know, you have to say that it's because in Spain and Italy and Portugal, where you've had huge groupings on the left, many young people there see these groupings as tainted because they have collaborated with one or the other of the parties in power. And the people in Syriza, in Greece, never did that. They are not tainted by that. And as a result of that, they were able to say it and attack both and say, yeah, PASOK has been a complete disaster for us in Greece. So this is what I stressed in my talk, that one must never underestimate the importance of politics. And you know, being very clear about what the aims are, whether you're in a minority, it's sort of irrelevant. You have to fight for that. I mean, look at the speed with which Syriza developed in a huge social crisis, from being a tiny minority who people were laughing at into a party on the threshold of winning state power, admittedly within the framework of elections, but that's the only way at the moment. And the South Americans have shown that too. And again, on the basis of mass mobilizations. So, and the other thing to be stressed is that one thing that damaged the Greek left was there were some incredibly sectarian proto-Stalinist currents living in dreamland. I mean, just horrific, really. I mean, I was shocked. I went to Athens before the elections to speak at the Polytechnic, which is a historic site where students were killed under the dictatorship. About, you know, a few thousand people there. And at one point when I was saying the sort of things I've been saying to you, but more centered on Greece, I said, I get the feeling that not all of you are going to vote for Syriza in this election. So can we just have a show of hands? Who is going to vote for Syriza? And to my relief, 3/4 of the people did. because they were not attached to some of the sectarian groups. So the sectarians just sat like this. And afterwards, there was a huge debate. And I said, guys and gals, these debates are not new. They've been taking place within the left for at least 150 years. And this is the last thing we need is any form of sectarianism. We have to unite forces, not divide our already weak forces. And just because Syriza has done it and you couldn't, that is not a reason not to vote for them.
So before I call on the last question, I'm really sorry to everybody who had their hands up that we weren't able to get to today, but we should stick around after, like I said. And I just want to make a quick pitch. If you like this event, if you like the books that Haymarket Books puts out, you should absolutely check out the Socialism Conference this summer in Chicago. There's information on the table in the back. The Center for Economic Research and Social Change, which publishes Haymarket Books, and the magazine The International Socialist Review is a sponsor of the conference. It's going to be a whole weekend of discussion and debate, and people should absolutely check it out. So we'll have the gentleman in red will be the last question.
You talked about a number of elections, and I think it's only about 2 weeks till the Pakistan election. I wonder if you would say something about
which one?
Pakistan.
Oh.
It's about 2 weeks away, right?
Yeah.
don't hold back.
Look, the elections. There is no left force in the country, okay? Effectively. There are small groups, well-meaning and nice people, but there is no effective political force on the left in Pakistan. So you essentially have the situation as follows. You have two political parties, one which is in power, the People's Party, which has been supported by Obama and Hillary Clinton for the last 5 years, which is one of the most corrupt parties in the country. But when I say that, I really mean it, that the president of the country openly makes money.
Yeah.
Well, 10% is, an old joke, and it's not an accurate joke. The figure is closer to 40 to 50%. And so he's a billionaire many times over. And it's not even a secret. We have hundreds of instances of the way they make money. So people are fed up with them. The alternative is, left and right have no meaning in this, or center left or center right. The other gang is a gang of old crooks who've been making money under the military dictatorship for ages, the Sharif brothers, who are, the opinion polls are showing them ahead. So haven't helped the country. For the last 25 years, it's these two different gangs who, whenever there are elections, come to power and make money. And there almost is nothing to choose between them. The third force that has come up is difficult to define in conventional terms. It's a political party called the Movement for Social Justice, led by Imran Khan, who was a huge sporter superstar. I don't know American football or baseball very well, but if a huge star from that milieu, very popular with the masses, stood for president against the Democrats and the Republicans on a mildly social democratic program. That is what is happening. And the program of this party is effectively free health, free education, subsidized housing, building of free schools and universities. That is no doubt. Ending of corruption. Well, how do you do it? But okay, at least it's a central slogan. And on foreign policy, removing Pakistan's complete dependence on the Pentagon and the United States and reviving some national sovereignty and not doing everything the United States tells us to. It's all moderately framed. Now, the interesting thing about this party is that it is backed by the young people. Its main support is the urban youth because they don't see anything else. They effectively like him, they like the program, and if they turn out and vote, who knows? I mean, it could upset the apple cart. It really could. Or even if this becomes the sort of second largest party and is in the opposition, The reason that's important is it opens up a new space for politics and political debate, and people feel we can do something. You know, we've got rid of these guys. I met him, you know, I know him quite well, and I said, what is the party organization like? And he surprised me. He said, look, this is really going to shock you, but we made a public appeal on television and the press saying, all those who support our program, will you please register as party supporters or members? And he said, I'll just show you the latest registration figure. And he, you know, clicked his iPhone. And at that point, when we were having dinner, 7.1 million people had registered. So I said to him, this truly is unprecedented in the whole subcontinent. If 7.1 million people have registered to back you, I mean, if they drag four more, each of them drags four people out, you've almost won. And he said, well, look, maybe, maybe not, but that is the figure. The second thing which is permitted is for constituents of the party branches to determine who they want to be their members of parliament, which has meant that in a whole number of regions where bandwagon careerists and others jumped on, the young activists have kicked them out and have elected their own nominees. So it's the only interesting thing, by the way, is to see how many votes this party gets. Not because, you know, one agrees with everything they do, but at least it will open up something different. So, I mean, I created a bit of a storm when I went and at a big event in Lahore just several weeks ago. They said, who would you vote for? So I said, I wouldn't vote for any of the major parties. And all the young people at the Lahore Literature Festival cheered and applauded. And then said, but if you were forced to vote, I said, I suppose, given what we've got, I would vote for this party just to defeat the two others. And the whole place erupted. So I said, well, if that's the mood you're in, it's up to you, really, because, you know, my vote doesn't count, and I'm not even going to vote. But you people can do this. So there is that atmosphere. I mean, in past elections, votes in Pakistan have been bought. I'm not joking. I mean, literally, you go into a village, you go into poor areas, and touts from both parties come and say, look, we'll pay you, you know, 1,000 rupees for our vote. Per vote, and the other guy comes in, no, we'll pay you 2,000 rupees. So there's an auction, open auctions. And so the people who offer more money usually win. This time, the Election Commission has declared a lot of people illegal and said if we're going to have people everywhere, if this happens, the candidate on whose behalf the money is being given will be disqualified. We'll see. We'll see. The good thing is that the Pakistani press, believe it or not, is much more open than the Indian press and much more than the American press. I mean, huge arguments and debates take place. All these politicians are confronted by opponents, by journalists questioning them, Imran, all of them are. And quite some of them are quite hard and cynical journalists who do it. And that is actually creating a political consciousness that I have not seen for a long, long time in that country. So, you know, we will see.